And turn in your Bibles, if you would, to Matthew chapter 2. We're not done worshiping, in case you wonder. But this week in particular seems like the right week that we worship in response. Matthew chapter 2, again, this is a different kind of thing, different kind of message, not exactly what you'd call a note-taking message. This is more what I believe God would speak to our hearts this morning. Because it was unexpected, it was ruthless, it was cold-blooded, it was wicked, it was evil, inexcusable. I mean, what word do you use to describe that kind of bloodshed? What words do you use to describe, I mean, a little bitty town in the middle of nowhere, on the way to nowhere, where the kind of place where people just try to raise a family in peace and get by, make a living, the kind of place that a lot of kids probably grow up just dreaming to move out of such a little town so they can go make it somewhere more exciting, the kind of place other people move to, but specifically for peace, quiet. Kind of place that never makes the news for anything dramatic, certainly nothing like this. And to have that kind of bloodshed, that kind of violence come out of nowhere on an unexpected group of people. I mean, look, when an adult suffers violence like that, when it's a grown-up, I mean, we have these words that we use. We'll say things like they were murdered. These innocent people were murdered. And we use those words kind of open-handedly. No, I don't think any of us believe that the adults that suffer such tragedy are inherently perfect. Like these are just saints that have never done anything wrong. But what we're talking about specifically is that in that specific event, that act of violence, whatever it is, they had done nothing to deserve or to initiate that particular act. We're not trying to claim global innocence for everybody, but when they're little kids, I mean, when they're little kids, what do you say to that? I mean, these are children. And how many? Some 20? What do you say to that? I mean, how do you put into words that? I mean, stuff like this tends to get a name in our history. Our history tends to name difficult events like this, mainly because, and not trying to be clever, they're not trying to be creative, but there are certain events that happen in history that need to be remembered, that need to be looked back on, that need to be contemplated, that need to be prayed through. And so these events tend to end up with certain names. So you get things like 9/11. Pearl Harbor, names that are intended sometimes to invoke emotion and memory of what's going on. And so then you have names going around regarding this event like the slaughter of the innocents. And it's something that will be remembered every year at Christmas, every year talked about, even though it happened on the other side of the planet over 2,000 years ago. I'm not talking about what happened in Connecticut yet. I'm talking about the events that surrounded the very birth of Jesus Christ, who we celebrate in this season. Now, for us right now, we are heavy with the burden of what happened in Connecticut. This event hit me really hard this year because, I don't know about you, there's certain events in our lives like this that happen, and you just kind of remember where you were when that happened. You know what I'm talking about? I remember several years ago, I had a car appointment on a Tuesday morning right here at the Subaru dealership to get my car worked on. A coworker picked me up early in the morning so that I could drop it off. He says, "Did you see what happened last night?" I'm a Denver Bronco football fan. In the game the night before, Denver's one of their best wide receivers, leg, was broken in a grotesque injury. And I'm like, "Yeah, I saw what happened. That was awful. I can't believe it. What's going to happen?" He goes, No. A plane crashed into one of the World Trade Centers. And it was just, what are you talking about? And the rest of that day at our office was spent glued to the TV screens. And I remember watching, and it was like every time you checked the news, every time you checked the internet, every time you checked on the TV, it just got worse. You remember that? Like the numbers go up, now another building's been hit, now one building's come down, now another building's come down, oh, the Pentagon got hit, oh, another plane crashed in the middle of nowhere, and you're just like, come on, it can't get worse than this, can it? And that's, for a lot of us, that's how it felt Friday, didn't it? You remember seeing that? I mean, the first report said two people, and one was supposed to be the gunman, and then it was numbers just kept going up, and numbers just kept going up, and then you hear it's 18 children, and then two more children die at the hospital, and now it's 20 children, and then you have, oh, the tangent, but you have these cameras going in front of third graders coming out of the school, and there's just this heartache that's going down. And so for me and for my family, and I wrote an article about this and put it on our website, some of you have seen this, but that day was our scheduled kind of Christmas outing for our family. We have this family tradition every year. We get the kids in pajamas. We go through a drive-thru somewhere. We get like one of those peppermint shakes or something like that, something Christmassy. We play old jazz Christmas tunes on the radio, and we just drive around town looking at Christmas lights. And we do that every single year. The kids anxiously look forward to it. And so we were planning on doing that night. But this year it was different. I don't know how to explain it. And I understand things hit me differently since I've become a dad. They just do. And so when stuff like this happens, I find myself mentally going to where those people are, putting myself in that situation. What if that was me? What if that was my kid? And it becomes a really difficult thing. And so this year, it was really different. We pulled our family around. We got together in the living room right before we were go. We all got our jackets on, the pajamas, the whole deal. Yeah, we drove in pajamas. Get over it. So that's what we did. And I had to explain to my two children, 8 and 6 years old, and say, this is what happened today. And these kids were, well, Allie, they were your age. And we talked about the fact that there are a lot of Christmas gifts. And we pointed to our tree and the gifts under it, that there's a lot of Christmas gifts that aren't going to get opened this year by these kids. There's a lot of families that are going to be hurting, that Christmas is going to become this dark reminder to some degree, year after year after year, of the tragedy that they've been through. And so we gathered together and we just prayed. We both praying for the families over there that were going through such difficulty and thanking God for the mercy to be able to be the parents to my children just one more day. We don't think about that stuff on a normal time until this kind of thing happens. Well, tragedies like that, like what happened in Portland, like what happened in Connecticut, when you're in a place like we are now where everyone's asking questions, where everyone's going, what's going on, and that's all anyone's talking about, then this is the time that we need to be able to come to our Heavenly Father and to His Word to see, Lord, what do you have to share with us through this? And in His sovereignty, in His providence, we have Matthew chapter 2. Beginning in verse 1, it says this. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea. For so it was written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. And then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. And after listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. And they fell down and worshiped him. And then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And then being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take this child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you. For Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed. And he remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." And then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. And then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel, weeping for her children, she refused to be comforted because they are no more. Now, this is a Christmas story that no doubt all of us are familiar with. I mean, how many times have we heard this story? We've seen the pageants, the kids dressed up as the three kings, and all of that stuff. We're familiar with it, but if we're not careful, it's really easy to skip over such a tragic message as what is buried deep into the context of this story, and that's Herod's murderous decree to have all these children in Bethlehem murdered. Now, Herod, to give you a little backstory to understand what was going on and what kind of a man he is, Herod, he's named king of the Jews, but he himself is not a Jew. He's an Edomite. He is a descendant of Esau, and he and the Edomite people are a continual plague on the people of Israel throughout history. If you know the story of Esther, there's a man named Haman, and what's his desire? To eradicate the Jewish people. Haman was an Edomite. And there's continual conflict and stories of how the Edomite people are warring against God's chosen people, the people of Israel, descendants of Jacob. And so this man is proclaimed and anointed king of the Jews, though he is not a Jew, so that's an extra stab in the back of the Jewish people there. He's given this title by Rome, who is in charge of the area at that time. So he's king, but he's a puppet king. He still has to answer to the Roman authorities. Now, he had a plethora of enemies. The Jewish people were his enemies, especially the religious leaders. Not long before this story happens, history tells us that King Herod decided to build some statues of these golden eagles and have them placed inside the Jewish temple. And when the Jewish leaders saw this, they were incensed, and they had their students, their followers, go and take them down and throw them out. And Herod heard, and he was so angry, he had all those students rounded up and killed in public in front of everyone. And so the Jewish leaders were angry at Herod. Even other historical figures, for example, Cleopatra was a mortal enemy of King Herod, wanted his land. And he was making a lot of enemies in Rome, actually, because his ruthless way of dealing with things was causing so many waves that Rome was getting tired of cleaning up his messes. Well, he was also a murderous man. He was known as a murderer through much of his reign, and it only got worse. You see, as Herod got older, he was stricken with some horrible medical difficulties. In fact, by the time of the story here in Matthew chapter 2, he's actually near death. He had a plethora of medical issues, everything ranging from stomach issues to tumors in his feet to gangrene. And instead of allowing that kind of difficulty and pain to humble him, it emboldened him and it enraged him. And so as he got older and older, he got angrier and angrier. He had 10 wives, and out of those wives, children through all of them, and those children were constantly in rivalry, wanting to succeed him in his throne, which made him suspicious always and very anxious. And so as he got closer and closer to death, his own children were positioning for the throne. And so the ruthless way in which he had dealt with most of the world around him turned inward, and he began to deal with his family in such a way. He had had his favorite wife murdered. He had two of his stepsons strangled. He had another of his actual birth sons murdered for even speculating at the possibility that he might one day inherit the throne. And the Roman emperor famously said of him, "It is better to be Herod's hog than his son," because of the way that he treated his family. And so at the time of this story in Matthew chapter 2, we have a man who is increasingly paranoid of losing his reign, who is literally dying, and who is a known and murderous madman, constantly suspicious. And then these wise men come out of nowhere and they say, "Hey, the King of the Jews has been born. Where is he?" Well, you can imagine how that would sit with a man like this. And so he puts this plan into motion and says, "I'll tell you what, let's find out where they are." And it doesn't take long to go back into the Hebrew scriptures and find out that it's been foretold that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem. And so he comes up with this plan and says, "I'll tell you what, you guys, you kings, you wise men as we call them, go on into Bethlehem, find the King of the Jews, and then let me know so I can worship him." And so the wise men go on their way, and there they find Jesus. They worship him. They give these gifts to him. But then the Lord comes to them in a dream and lets them know, "You are not to go back by way of Jerusalem because Herod desires to kill this child." And so they faithfully obey and they go a different direction home so that they don't go through there. The Lord also appears to Joseph in a dream and says, "Your family's in danger. You need to pack them up and get out of here." And so Joseph and his family pack up and they make their way down to Egypt. In the area of Alexandria, there was a large Jewish population. They would find friends there. They would find provision there. They would find shelter there. And so Joseph gets the family up, packs up this child, and they make their way off into Egypt. Now, there's a verse here that's speculatory, or that could cause speculation if it'd be really easy for us to miss this. Because if you ever wondered, what it would have been like to be the families in Bethlehem? I mean, until this week, I never had. It never even occurred to me. I mean, I remember thinking about Herod and how wicked he is, but never really putting myself in the position of a family who has just lost their child, 2 years old and under, a whole generation, if you will, of kids, a whole age group. I mean, how do you put yourself in that position? What would that have been like? It really wasn't until this week that I think maybe we could get a little bit of glimpse into what exactly that might look like, as we see almost an entire grade level of children wiped out, shot ruthlessly, some as many as 11 times in Connecticut this week. What would it have looked like in Bethlehem? And their only crime? They live in the same town that Jesus was born in. Well, there's a verse here. There's a verse here in this passage in Matthew 2:15, where Matthew says, "This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" It'd be really, really easy to miss this. But here in this particular verse, Matthew says there's a prophecy. "Out of Egypt I've called my son," that's about Jesus, and he had to go to Egypt to fulfill this prophecy. And in this, he's quoting Hosea. In Hosea 11:1, that's where the actual prophecy comes from. It says in its context, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." But as you look at it, there's something unique about this prophecy that Matthew reaches to that's different from the other prophetic instances that Matthew shows to be fulfilled. And Matthew, maybe more than any of the other gospels, does this. We'll talk about something that happened to Christ, and then we'll say, "This happened to fulfill the scriptures." But this one's different. Because in so many of those, it seems to be a plain and obvious messianic promise that had been told in the Old Testament scriptures, that when the Messiah comes, this would happen. This is what he would look like. But when you go to this verse in Hosea, in 11 chapter 1, to see what he's talking about, it doesn't look like he's talking about the Messiah at all. He's talking about Israel in Hosea. And he says that, speaking of God, that God had delivered them out of Egypt. Now, the story that is being referred to there in Hosea is the original deliverance of the people in the book of Exodus from Egypt. Let me ask you, what happened in Egypt? Israel, enslaved to Pharaoh and his wicked rule, Though they were growing because God was blessing them, he began to fear that the people of Israel would grow in number and be able to take over his throne. And so he issued a wicked and evil decree that every male son born of the people of Israel be killed. It's the same story. But God preserved one, a guy named Moses. And through miraculous works, Moses is raised and grows up in Egypt. And God uses Moses as the one who will deliver the suffering people of Israel from Egypt. God works through this. And in Hosea, he's reaching back to this to say, when Israel was a child, I loved him. Out of Egypt, I called my son, he says. Now, people would criticize and have. Scholars have criticized Matthew, though, for using this quote. Because they would say, Matthew, that doesn't really apply to Jesus. It's talking about Israel, not about Jesus. It looks like him, but is the prophecy the same? And in that, they're sorely mistaken. Because what Matthew understands and what God would have us understand is that this shows the lengths and the determination and the plan that God had to make sure that we understand how far Christ would go to identify with our pain and difficulties. That was the purpose. Look, Jesus didn't come to earth born a king in a palace, in a castle, and then die that way. Jesus Christ was born, and his birth alone was marked by immeasurable suffering and difficulty, poverty. And so was his death. That this is what marked the very life of Jesus Christ. Isaiah 53:3 says, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, but acquainted with grief. Hebrews 4, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness. When Jesus Christ came, part of the point of the incarnation of Christ, when he dwelt human flesh and lived here amongst us, was that we would identify with him, or maybe more appropriately, he would identify with us. That he took on the same griefs, the same sorrows, the same difficulties. He did not lead by any means a charmed life. He was rejected by everyone. So that when these kinds of things happen, like what happened this week, that we can go to him as someone who gets it, as someone who understands, as someone who's been through something like this. And as Psalm 34 says, the Lord is near the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. And so now, in a time like this, when there's uncertainty, when there's questions, when there are people that you're going to be talking to on Monday at work, family members, neighbors, even you yourselves have questions like, what is going on here? When there's uncertainty and people are trying to figure out what's going on, we always need to return to truth. We need truth to land on when there's uncertainty. We need truth to land on. Jesus Christ said that it is truth that will set us free. We need some things that are dependable, that we know, that we can cling and hold to in these types of things. The church especially needs them. So let me share a couple with you. Number one is this. Please know this. There is pure evil all over this world. There just is. I mean, can we disregard now forever the notion that people are just inherently good when we see what happened this week? Man, watch and see what happens. This is what seems to happen every time. See, mankind right now is very humanistic. Even those who don't believe in a God, they have a God. It's themselves. It's humanity. And so when things like this happen, we don't want to believe that there's anything in us that could ever do something. So our tendency as a culture tends to be, we need to find the reasons, the things that cause something this bad to happen, because surely it couldn't just happen. Like, there's got to be a reason. And we see this all the time. That's why when 9/11 happens, we try to explain it away. And so they go, no, it's not that it's Islam or anything like that. Man, those are peaceful people. These are just lunatic fringe people. And just try to explain it away, because we can't embrace the fact that there could be this much wickedness on the earth. And so watch and see. It's starting already. It goes from everything to, we'll talk about medical conditions, we'll talk about what the parents did wrong, we'll talk about what the school could have done different, we'll talk about what laws could be in place to prevent something like this, and we will talk about everything under the sun except sin. Now, don't get me wrong. If there were medical conditions that play a part in what's going on, what went on over there, I get that. Those of you that have been tracking with me, you know I am very sympathetic to mental illnesses and all those things. But even those illnesses are a result of sin. They are here because we live in a terribly fallen world. It is not good. And so when a professional football player murders his girlfriend in front of his three-month-old child, and then you see people on the news go, he was a good guy, he wasn't violent. That is stupid. He is horribly violent if he would do that. Is he disturbed? Sure. But that's wickedness. That is evil. That is the fruits of sin in a fallen world. And as Christians, we should not shy away from that. Ours is the only faith out there that has an explanation for this kind of stuff. Our faith is the only faith on earth that has the cure for sin. But when we try to take it into all these other things, like counseling issues or all that, and disregard the notion of sin, we're just feeding this humanistic religion that's out there and telling people, it's okay, you're good, this probably won't happen again, especially if we have some good laws and people parent better. There's wickedness in this world. Number two, the wickedness that's in this world, it's not new. We've got to avoid the misconception that says that it's getting worse, because this has always happened. The first parents on the face of the earth, Adam and Eve, they had a son who was murdered and another son who was a murderer. Right out the gate. They know what it's like right out the gate to identify with the people that are in Connecticut right now. When Noah, the story of Noah, God said there was wickedness on their minds continually. The people there. And here we see, even surrounding the very birth of Jesus Christ, the same thing. In Bethlehem at that time, the population in Bethlehem and its outlying regions, they tell us would have been around 1,000 people, and people doing estimates, figuring stats, all that kind of stuff, say there would have been about 20 kids, about 20 male children in Bethlehem that would have been murdered. Same thing that we saw this week. This is not new. This is not a recent development. Which leads to number three. This evil that does exist and is not new, this is why he came. When people say, where was God in this? Your answer shouldn't be trying to attach to some emotional feeling here to try to go, oh, but he's going to bring peace. Our first answer should be, where is he? This is why he came. And the scriptures even talk about the fact that we are to abhor what is evil, and that is how we are Christ-like in our hearts. That this wickedness, when we see it, if you say, where was God in this? You say, God hates this. This is the kind of wickedness. 1 John 3:8 says this. This is such a key verse. 1 John 3:8 says, for this purpose the Son of God was manifest. Why do we celebrate Christmas? Why was Jesus Christ incarnated, Emmanuel, God with us? For this purpose. That he might destroy the works of the devil. Christ did not come to necessarily comfort us in difficulty. He came to end the difficulty. He came to destroy it. And the only reason that he hasn't eradicated all of this kind of wickedness in totality is because he's also incredibly patient and he longed to save you. Because if he had done it years ago, where would we be? That's where God is. Where is God? He's in the arms of people who do go and put arms around the hurting. Where is God? He's in the churches in those communities that have incredible responsibility and opportunity to reach out, bless, and love on people there. Where is God? He's in that dad that was on the news last night talking about his now deceased little girl and praising God for the gifts that he had poured into that little girl. Even quick to say, it wasn't my parenting. God made this little girl like that. That's where God is. We have this belief that when evil comes, God disappeared. No, when evil came, that's when God came to eradicate the works of evil. Isaiah 61, the prophetic words of Isaiah about Jesus says that the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor.
He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives, to open prisons for those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness. We've got to get away from the belief that if God's there, there's no suffering. No, it's where the suffering is that God comes. To bring peace and joy and happiness. And that's why it's our responsibility, Christians, to be the arms and feet of Christ, to go into those difficult situations and shine light into darkness, which, number four, the light of the church was designed to shine in this kind of darkness. That's why we're here. To go into difficult situations when people don't know what to do, don't know what to think, don't know what to say, and to be the embodiment of Christ now, pointing people to Jesus, wiping off tears, throwing arms around them, bringing food, meals, taking care of them. That's our purpose. This is not a time when Christians should shy back and get defensive about our faith. Ignore those questions if you have to, but these are the kind of times when you go forward and you proclaim the fact that there is one who has come, that we are celebrating him in this season right now, and he came specifically to eradicate the kind of difficulty that's here, and there's no other name under heaven that will save us from this kind of pain. And this is why we're here, to proclaim him. And number five, he did it. God won. I mean, don't forget this. Yeah, there's difficulty. Yeah, there's still pain. But listen to the words of Jesus right before he died to his apostles in John 16. Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament. The world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn into joy. When a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come. But when she's delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish. For joy that a human being has been born into this world, so also you have sorrow now. But I will see you again. And your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. I have said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Don't forget, Christians, that this is not bumper sticker theology. This is truth. This has been done. The wickedness that has committed these kinds of acts in Portland, in Connecticut, in Denver movie theaters, in China, the very next night a man goes with a knife and does these things. The very same wickedness, it's been defeated. And the only reason it hasn't been eradicated now is because Christ desires to save more. And he knows that the reward on the other side of this suffering is going to make this look like nothing by comparison. It's not fake. It's not just a bumper sticker. Now, don't be fake. Don't bounce around like, oh, your son died, but he's in heaven. Don't do that. Like, we can be real. We should weep with them. We should hurt with them. But we do not weep as if we have no hope. Because our hope is in Jesus Christ, who has already defeated this. Yes, there is a voice, as Jeremiah says, that there's this voice heard in Ramah, that Rachel is weeping for her children and refuses to be comforted because they are no more. That's a voice right now in our culture. That's a real voice. But for those who have put their faith in Jesus Christ, there's another voice to be heard. And it says this: Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. I will dwell with them, and they will be my people. God himself shall be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore. For the former things have passed away. And he who is seated on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. He said, Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And to the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. And that's why we worship. That's why we celebrate Christmas. That's your real meaning of Christmas. The fact that we have difficulty. We are dead in sin, but Jesus Christ did not just stand by and go, well, I hope they work that out. He indwelt himself into our problem. And he became a helpless little child. He walked perfectly through this earth. He did not sin, though he was tempted just like us, that he might be that acceptable sacrifice who went to the cross on our behalf. All that guilt, all that sin, all that shame, all that darkness, all that pain, he carried to the cross on our behalf, and he won. Oh, he died, but he rose again, showing his power over death, showing that he is who he claimed to be. And the word tells us now he has ascended into heaven where he is seated at the right hand of the Father, and he's praying for you and me. He's praying for people in Connecticut. He's praying for people in our family right now. And he is coming. Don't forget that. And so this is a time to worship. It's not about ignoring pain, and that's not some fake Christian way of getting out of here, out of this and ignoring the pain. We worship him through the pain because he's the only source that can fit. He is our balm of Gilead. It's all about him. So I beg you this morning, worship him. Don't let your stupid pride, fears, bad voice, whatever it is in your life, get in the way of declaring the greatness of the God who saves you. Can we pray?